It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It is Tuesday, April 30th, 2024. I'm Guy Benson from Charleston, South Carolina today. I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for listening. Between 3 and 6 p.m. Eastern, that's every weekday. And then when the show's over, the whole show becomes a podcast. It's free. It's on demand. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got a lot to get to here on the show today. If you're kind of new around these parts, we're extra glad that you've joined us. I'm political editor at townhall.com, where I do my writing. Also a Fox News contributor. Lots of TV stuff coming up later in the week. And then, of course, this program with a lineup as follows for today. Aaron Seberium of the Washington Free Beacon. He has uncovered evidence of close coordination among these campus radical mobs, the pro-Hamas hate rally encampment organizers across multiple campuses. This is not organic. They're also being funded. We'll get into some of those details with Aaron. Katie Pavlich is going to be here later on in the show as well. Looking forward to that conversation. A few different things to touch on with Katie. Kerry Urban is Fox News legal editor. We'll talk about the latest out of the Trump trial, a decision on that gag order controversy in New York City from the Biden donor judge in that case. We'll get her analysis ahead on the program. And also Charles C.W. Cook. Just after 5 p.m. Eastern time, I always look forward to having him here, not just for his intellect and his insight, but also his exquisite British accent. He will be here talking about truly unsettling, disturbing, enraging times on so many campuses and episodes across the country at colleges and universities. And I will get his thoughts on all of that ahead. I also want to start on that very topic with you here today. Focusing on developments out of Columbia and UCLA specifically. We'll get to Northwestern later. There's something out of Michigan I want to talk about. It's like drinking from a fire hose. But we told you yesterday on the show that the Columbia University leadership, quote-unquote, team, including the president, had given a final ultimatum, at least supposedly. They put it out. They said 2 p.m. deadline yesterday. So we're talking like 25 hours ago was the deadline for the encampment to be cleared, and then they were going to start making arrests and suspensions and all of that. And with the deadline given, you had a bunch of faculty come out in support of the pro-Hamas mob. They're actually part of it, frankly. You had more students coming to basically defend the encampment against any action that the school might take, having sworn, hey, this is what we're going to do. And this has been going on for weeks. There have been negotiations, which I think is just so embarrassing, but the negotiations broke down, what, a night or two ago. One of the negotiators on the student side, at least until recently, was this kid who was on camera talking about how he wanted all Zionists dead and kind of fantasized about doing the murdering himself. Then they finally booted him from these conversations, and then they went even further south. And the school, at least seemingly, had had enough. Said, all right, here's the deadline, here's the red line, you can stand down or there will be consequences, and here we are 25 hours later, the encampment is still there, seems like nothing has happened in terms of the enforcement side. The school has reportedly, according to NYPD sources, said don't intervene to law enforcement officials up to this point. I mean, I don't know, what's the point of laying down rules if you're going to immediately roll over? It is so dangerous. It is worse than just weakness. It's so provocative. And it incentivizes more of this. It invites more of this. And in fact, just the threat of consequences sent the pro-Hamas mob into a frenzy. They printed out copies of the school's warning, and they wrote in big red letters all over it, Columbia will burn, we're not reading this. All these completely disrespectful statements, basically saying, we don't believe you, we will not comply. I don't know what leadership at Columbia was thinking. They just say, oh, okay, well, it's a final warning, so they'll listen to us. Of course not. I mean, how stupid, ignorant, foolish can you be at this point? And then last night, things escalated. The mob broke into one of the buildings on campus, Hamilton Hall, and took it over. There were a handful of Jewish students trying to protect the building, blocking access to it. Because remember, this mob has already cordoned off part of campus, and if you're a Zionist, you're not allowed in. It's crazy that this is being allowed to happen at all. School has said you can't do it, they just keep doing it anyway. And now they want to expand their occupation to include a building. A handful of students are trying to defend the building. God knows where the police are. They're being told not to show up. Campus security, nowhere to be found. So you've got a few students just standing there peacefully, and they were berated, and then they were assaulted. And these people, thugs, pushed past them. There is video of them smashing windows in this building and then taking it over. And then at least for a while, there were some custodians, some janitors, who say that they were stuck in the building and held briefly against their will. They weren't allowed to leave at first, is what the custodians have said. I mean, if that's true, I have no reason to suggest that these custodians are lying about what happened, since they were in the building when it got taken over by this crowd. It'd be very on brand, almost a little too on the nose, for Hamas supporters to be taking hostages. That's what Hamas tends to do. I guess at some point they realized, oh, we ought to let these people go, so they did, and on their way out, at least one of the janitors, and these guys said, like, these are blue-collar workers who tried to defend the building, completely overrun, and one of them was saying, yeah, they wouldn't let us leave at first, we were hostages, if briefly. So then earlier today, our colleague Lawrence Jones here at Fox, he went to Columbia. He caught up with one of the students, part of this organization. She's got her keffiyeh, her Palestinian scarf. She appears to be just a white chick. And he was asking her about what happened last night. Just listen. Just listen to Cut 26, this exchange.
Do you feel like it was right to hold three of the janitor workers hostage with inside of the building?
I think that's a really false narrative.
That's what the janitors are saying, that they weren't allowed to leave.
I think that that's a really false narrative.
Even if the janitors are saying that, you're saying that that's not true.
I think that it's a really false narrative that the students took anyone hostage.
How do you feel about some of the Jewish students saying that they don't feel safe here on campus?
I think that this is also a really false narrative that's being promoted.
Do you think October 7th and the attack that happened is a false narrative? Do you believe that some of the women were raped?
My colleague just came back.
This is what happened.
Can you get out of my face, please?
Ah. So the janitor said something happened, but that's a false narrative. And a lot of the Jews on campus feel unsafe. What about that? That's also a false narrative. Okay, was October 7th a false narrative? The murdering, the raping? Get out of my face. Our best and brightest Ivy League school. And by the way, if you look at the videos from last night, it is a mob of people that got violent, assaulting students on campus to invade and take over a campus building, smashing windows, and then occupying it, and unfurling banners, by the way. They said this is no longer called Hamilton Hall. They've renamed it something in their own minds. And they put these banners on the building, one of which, of course, calls for intifada, which is Jew-killing violence. That's what an intifada is. That's what intifadas have been. This is what they want more of. They're not just Hamas sympathizers. They're fans. They are brothers in arms and solidarity on behalf of terrorism and Jew-killing. That's what this is. And the university has apparently nothing to say about it. They had their gauntlet thrown, right? They said, here you go. You've got to get out by 2 p.m. yesterday or else, and then the or else still hasn't come and things got worse. The spiral deepened. I mean, I think there's probably no choice at this point, realistically, other than for this university president to resign. She is obviously completely unable to do the job. She is ruining this place before our very eyes, before the nation's eyes. And I have no sympathy at all for her. None. She went through the whole dance of a negotiation with these people. No. Be an adult, set the rules, and enforce them. It's just incapable. So get out. Get out if you can't do it. Then at UCLA, other side of the country, now Columbia gets a lot of taxpayer dollars, even though it's a private school. UCLA is a public university, taxpayer-funded public school. We told you yesterday about a scene where a Jewish student was just trying to get to class, but these Hamas supporters have now taken over parts of campus and they're not allowing free movement. They're not allowing Zionists or Jewish students or anyone not part of their cult to pass through like checkpoints on a campus that doesn't belong to them. This is a campus that belongs to everyone, all the students at a public school, but if you're a Jewish student who disagrees with them, not wearing a Palestinian headdress and mask, none shall pass the pro-terrorism checkpoint. And this Jewish student's like, I need to get to class. I want to go through. And he's pointing. And they just stare at him. They don't even talk to him. Like he's some sort of subhuman. Then when he tries, nonviolently, he puts his hands up in the air and tries to just walk through. They block him and they bring this giant goon in another keffiyeh to come over and sort of add muscle to not let the Jew get to class. This is UCLA. This is all on camera, and there's a university security guard standing there watching everything. I'm telling you, the lawsuits are already starting to fly at Columbia. I've heard rumblings of other schools as well. There is so much evidence piling up. So, for example, here is a parent who released a 911 call that was made, and this is making the rounds. If this is authentic, I have no reason to believe it's not. This is the 911 dispatcher in an exchange with a parent who was very upset about what's happening at UCLA, Jewish students not allowed to move freely through their own campus. We've seen it on video with the security guy standing right there. Here's cut 10, part of that phone call that allegedly happened.
So the university has taken a stance that they will not, in fact, allow or help Jewish students get to their classes, that this is going to be tolerated.
They have, we've received a directive to not intervene at this time, yes.
So you're allowing the protesters to block the Jewish students from
I'm
going?
I'm not allowing it.
Yeah.
The school is, the school is saying that they will not be removed at this time.
I mean, that would be yet another, if authenticated, another exhibit in what should be an extremely expensive lawsuit against UCLA. I don't know what else to say. Some of these people should be just arrested. Arrested, charged, expelled, but it goes beyond it. There has to be accountability for the adults ostensibly in charge allowing this to happen. What a disgrace. In the United States of America, Jewish students not being allowed, to walk freely to their own classes on campus, being stopped at checkpoints by masked terrorism supporters. It feels like a fantasy nightmare type scenario, but it's real. I'm pointing out UCLA because that's where the latest videos have come from, but this is happening across the country to varying degrees. Here's another element of what happened at UCLA, another vignette. This is at the library. This is a different checkpoint where a Jewish student just wants to walk through his own library at his own school. Cut 9.
I mean no harm. I'm just standing here. Just showing you guys how pointless your blockade is. I got in through the other entrance and now I'm standing here. You guys want to prevent Jewish students from entering? Fine. Of course I'm Zionist.
Yeah, we don't have Zionists in a
Okay, so So you don't let Zionists in the library that I pay tuition for?
If you watch the longer clip, you can at some point hear echoing in the background screams of Allahu Akbar. This is Los Angeles, California, on the campus of UCLA. Screaming Allahu Akbar, here's a Jewish student trying to walk through his own library at his school. And you couldn't hear it, but if you watch it and turn up the volume, he says, you guys want to prevent, excuse me, you guys want to prevent Jewish students from entering. And then one of these Hamas supporters says, no, we've got a couple Jewish students. Are you a Zionist? Then you heard the response, yeah, of course I'm a Zionist. Well, you can't enter. We don't let Zionists enter. So if you're a Jew, or anyone else, but if you're a Jew who supports Israel, 90%+ of Jews in this country, 80% of Americans, based on a brand new poll from Harvard-Harris, I know all these people get so much attention, they're a small minority. This is a 4-to-1 issue in favor of Israel in the United States. But if you're on the 4 side, out of the 4-to-1, you can't walk around UCLA's campus, apparently, even if you're a student. Are you a Zionist? Yes. Well, then you can't come through here. Allahu Akbar. I mean, maybe we're losing our capacity to be stunned and revolted by these things, but I am nevertheless stunned and revolted by this. A lot of things need to happen, a lot. Civil rights investigations, you can go down the list. But immediately, high-dollar, painful lawsuits against these schools and the administrators personally. You have to force accountability because these gutless, useless cowards are letting this happen. And these bums, these pro-terrorism bums, are running the show at a lot of these places. It makes me sick. One of whom at the University of Michigan has gotten some glowing press, but I'll tell you what he had to say right after this break on The Guy Benson Show.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective.
The Guy Benson Show.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Guy Benson. We're back. We talked about how one of the top leaders of the Hamas mob at Columbia was on camera talking about how all Israel supporters should be dead, calling for their deaths, fantasizing about doing it himself. Well, at the University of Michigan, I guess there's a very similar kindred spirit. This is from New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait, on the left, writing about this. He says, at the University of Michigan, the leader of the main student anti-Israel group, who's been sympathetically profiled in the New York Times and given the university's prestigious award for students who, quote, best exemplify the leadership and extraordinary vision of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that person wrote on social media, quote, until my last breath, I will utter death for every single individual who supports the Zionist state. Death and more. Death and worse. End quote. Write him up in the New York Times. Give him awards. Death to the Zionists. Death and worse. That's what he put on his social media. Jonathan Chait writes, the most violent and unhinged statements are not coming from the periphery of the protests, but from their leadership, because the most committed members of those groups are thoroughly absorbed in their radical commitments and their dehumanization. Disgusting.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan. But you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you subscribe to the podcast, like, subscribe, and share.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
GuyBensonShow.com is our online home. Check out our podcast there if you miss any of the show. As we continue here, a Fox News alert to bring to your attention. This is from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, just a continuation of what we were just talking about at several other schools, like the University of Michigan, like UCLA, like Columbia. This is UNC Chapel Hill, an alert put out by the administration to students, and I'm just going to quote, due to today's demonstrations on campus, UNC Chapel Hill will operate at Condition 2, effective on Tuesday, April 30th, starting at 3 p.m. This means that classes are canceled for the remainder of the day and non-mandatory operations are suspended. So they've canceled classes. They've canceled classes at UNC for the day because of the Hamas crowd doing what it does. These people are actively preventing other students and community members from going about their daily lives, even getting to classes, going to the library. This is what this conduct is wreaking across multiple campuses. And I just wonder, will there come a time where the people in charge, nominally and otherwise, say enough and actually crack down on this? But this is the latest manifestation at UNC. Joining us now to discuss this overall theme is Aaron Sabarian. He's a staff writer at the Washington Free Beacon. Aaron, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to delve into something that you've been reporting on. I've been following with some interest. This is a series of documents that you've obtained that prove, they don't just indicate, they show, they demonstrate, that some of these radicals involved at the heart of the encampment movement, if you want to call it that, at various campuses, elite schools, they are trading notes. They are collaborating with each other. They are coordinating with each other. What have you learned?
Yeah, so shortly before Princeton University students attempted to form their own encampment, they had a meeting with the organizers of the Columbia encampment to basically get tips on how to take over campus. And what they were told in that meeting was that they should pick a public space that the university needs. Columbia's occupiers are, or they were initially, on the lawn where commencement takes place. And they were also told, I think this is the most interesting thing, that not to worry too much about consequences, because at Columbia they were pretty sure that suspensions would be cleared. It wouldn't be the end of the world, and as long as you pick the right spot and organize carefully, you know, you'll have enough leverage, basically, to prevent yourself from getting in serious trouble. So they basically, the Columbia students, gave the Princeton students a playbook to take over campus, and the Princeton students at least attempted to follow it. The school responded more aggressively than they expected, but they were able to set up a kind of encampment, and that's been going on for a few days now, and it escalated yesterday with a takeover of a campus building and some arrests.
And that was at Columbia or that was at Princeton?
That was at Princeton, inspired by the Columbia playbook. Obviously, oh. Columbia just last night, it escalated further with the occupation of Hamilton Hall. So
yes,
there's a lot
yes.
of
when you're talking about building takeovers, we have to specify at this point
yes.
because
yes.
this is now the new hotness. I guess they're bored of just their, you know, glamping on the quad. Now they have to break into buildings and take them over. Columbia leading the way again. And I think what you just said is the most important element of this, which is they are baking into their expectations, written down in these documents that they were sharing. They were baking in the expectation of no real consequences for their actions. And it's probably, I mean, we've seen, it's been the right calculation up to this point, right? They have correctly predicted that nothing would really happen to them. And it seems like they're almost trying to push the envelope on a daily basis further and further how much they can get away with, almost to flex the power that they have over absolutely feckless administrators. I almost wonder, Aaron, if Columbia or any of these major schools, if the administration decided that they were going to actually surprise the students and really put and, you know, sort of dish out suspensions, expulsions, have a bunch of arrests, permanent record stuff, you will not be welcome back on campus, no, you cannot graduate, no, you cannot walk with your graduating class, you know, you cannot access your dorm or dining halls or anything like that, if they were to basically break the incentive structure and disprove this underlying assumption that there will be no consequences in a very public kind of bruising way, the whole model would, I think for at least a lot of these students, it would fall apart. Because some of the hardcore radicals would probably go on till the bitter end. But I think a lot of these sort of lazy, entitled hangers-on, I think a lot of them would drop like flies real fast if they felt like, oh, wait, this is going to affect me in a real negative way. That's my read on it, and it seems like the protesters, whatever you want to call them, actually agree with that.
Yeah, I think that that is basically right. And I would hone in on something you said, which is they seem to be pushing as far as they possibly can. They may have their kind of set of first-order demands that they want about divestment and all that, but I really think this is something deeper. I think it is about a show of force, and it's about kind of consolidating a generational transfer of power within liberal elite institutions. I think it's a continuation of the story of the cancel culture from the past decade, of the convulsions within liberal institutions like the New York Times after 2020. In all of these cases, it's been this younger activist generation that's trying to displace a kind of older, more moderate generation of liberals. And part of how you do that is just by – through kind of effectively raw displays of power that put your kind of generational enemies in a bad position. And that's exactly what they're doing now. And because of the fecklessness of these administrators, I would argue that they are broadly succeeding. And the takeaway in the future is going to be, yeah, you know, you can push pretty hard and get away with stuff. So we should just keep pushing harder until we effectively take over these institutions and just have a policy veto.
Yeah, no, it's a power struggle. No doubt. And one side, at least at some of these places, has been winning. And I just come back to my point. The people who actually wield the real power, the administrative power, if they wanted to, could put an end to almost all of it by saying, okay, we have identified these dozen leaders of this encampment. We've identified this student that used a racial slur. We identified this student who harassed and then assaulted a Jewish student. We have identified this student who smashed a window at Hamilton Hall and broke in. And all of these people are expelled from Columbia effective immediately. They will no longer be welcome back on campus, and they will not graduate from this institution. And our decision is final. That, I think, would go a very long way. But
yeah,
these people obviously are so unbelievably weak and or agree with the thrust of what's going on that they are incapable or unwilling to do that. I mean, I don't know what other conclusion you can draw. So then the question becomes, you know, how do you pressure the adults, quote unquote, to actually enforce rules if they don't really want to?
Well, I mean, in red states, it seems like they don't have this problem because the at least at the public universities, because the public universities are accountable more directly to the public. And, you know, you're seeing the encampments get broken up and not necessarily through police force, too. I would note in many cases, they just sort of announce like very clearly early on, if you do this, we're kicking you out. And they know the students there know that that's a credible threat. So they don't push it. In these blue states and private universities, I mean, I think it basically is going to have to spiral even more out of control than it already has for them to do anything. And even that might not be enough. I think in the longer term, I think what kind of has to happen is Congress has to basically put its foot down on the federal funding and say, oh, you know, you want to turn your campuses into playgrounds for radicals? Well, all right, that's fine. You don't get a cent of federal money. There's been an endowment tax proposed. Frankly, I mean, I think they should put even more extreme measures on the table and really just say, like, you know, we will not have the federal government involved in private higher education at all if you guys keep this up. I mean, I think the threat really needs to be pretty draconian to get them to take it seriously.
Well, I think
I
think it's going to take a Republican Congress and probably a Republican president to do that. I think there's no chance with an election pending that the Democrats, especially Joe Biden, would go along with that for the same reasons that they've been indulging all sorts of disgusting things in the name of trying to win certain votes in certain places. I saw that the College Democrats, the official arm, student arm of the Democrat Party, put out a statement praising the bravery of these students, talking about the Israeli genocide. I mean, that is the College Democrats, sort of the mainstream party apparatus, putting out statements like that. So unfortunately, it'll be bipartisan to an extent, but Republicans are going to have to drive that bus. And then for other people, because, I mean, acts of Congress or legislatures or even, you know, governors at the state level, that's one thing. I've also been now increasingly advocating, Aaron, for lawsuits. Because, I mean, it's money talks, and these administrators live in fear of multiple constituencies, and you just have to basically bully them using different means. They're being bullied by a Hamas crowd now, and if you start to make them worry that their funding's going to dry up or they're going to have massive lawsuits that they're going to have to settle or fight in court for huge amounts of money, that might focus some of their minds. So I expect civil rights and other related lawsuits like an avalanche across the country in a lot of these places.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Colombia is facing four separate ones right now, which is incredible. They've earned all of them. No, they have. I mean, the only thing I would say is that I could actually see a dynamic in which they also get sued by the pro-Palestinian kids, because one thing they've been pointing out, and they're not totally wrong, is that in the past, for past protests, students no consequences, so they're trying to make this argument that, you know, we're being singled out. And obviously there's a difference in scale, right, between some of the past occupations and this one. But, you know, in part because the universities let the madness go on for so long and didn't enforce their own policies for years when they should have, now the pro-Palestinian kids can claim with a little bit of credibility, hey, you singled us out, and that could itself be grounds for a lawsuit. So in some ways, no matter what they do, I think they're at some legal risk, which for those of us like me who just sort of are enjoying the show a little bit, quite frankly, I mean, it's kind of entertaining that they really can't do anything that will totally erase their liability.
Yeah, no, they've built this for themselves. They've made their own bed. There is an element that I think of like some schadenfreude where it's like, congratulations, this is the monster that you've built for years. Congratulations as you ruin and almost physically in some cases burn down your campus, your credibility, your reputation, all of that. The only element of it is it's all so wrong. It's all so sickening what this cause is that has, at least on the surface, triggered all of this. And it is deeply upsetting and in some cases dangerous for Jewish students. So that's the part that I can't enjoy. That's the part that I can't countenance. But it is the part that they can countenance. I mean, it seems like a lot of these administrators, they absolutely don't care that Jewish students on campus are being menaced and intimidated and in some cases physically assaulted. There's no indication that these people care that that's happening.
Yeah, and you know that at Columbia in 2018, a student was, I know, investigated and I think at least temporarily barred from campus for just saying to a crowd of, I think, black students, like, I love white people. White people are great. Now, obviously, the guy was trying to be provocative, but at the end of the day, all he did was just state, you know, basically, white people are great. And that was, and it took less than 24 hours for him to be persona non grata, administrative action to be taken, all of that. Here, we discover that a student in a disciplinary meeting, with Columbia administrators, doubled down on statements to the effect of, yes, I want Zionists to die, they should all be murdered. Nothing happens for months until the footage surfaces on Twitter. So,
that guy and others are out there chanting about Intifada and River to the Sea and all this stuff, you know, flagrant, explicit support for terrorism at the encampment and various signs and placards. I mean, that would be a legal double standard that I think could very much feed into some lawsuits that I think have to be forthcoming and in some cases have already materialized, but across the country. And you've got to make it painful for the weak people running these places. That's what you have to do. Unfortunately, they only respond to force and power, and absent, you know, lawless behavior, dangerous behavior, which of course I don't endorse, this is the way to bully them in the other direction. I don't see another recourse at this stage. It's really disgraceful to watch, and I know you've been following it and will continue reporting out all of what you're discovering at the Washington Free Beacon. A staff writer there, Aaron Sabarium, our guest on The Guy Benson Show. Aaron, thanks for your work. We'll have you back soon.
Thank you.
The Guy Benson Show is back. After this break, I want to give you some updates on a brand new poll. Seven swing states, seven battleground states were polled. Who's leading, Trump or Biden? We'll give you details next.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
Glad to have you here on The Guy Benson Show. Katie Pavlich joining us in the next hour. She is up next. So I teased before the break, let's pay it off. Emerson College and The Hill, brand new polling, seven swing states. Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. All of which Joe Biden won in 2020 with the exception of North Carolina. Trump narrowly carried North Carolina, lost the other six. Okay, where do things stand right now? Again, it's just a snapshot, just today. But these polls were in the field during the Trump trial in New York with all that coverage, heavy breathing coverage from the media. How's it playing out there in the battlegrounds? Well, according to Emerson and The Hill, in Arizona, Trump is up 4 points head-to-head. In a five-way race with RFK Jr. and others, Trump also up 4 points. In Georgia, in a two-way race, Trump is up 3 points over Joe Biden. In the five-way field, Trump is up 6 points. Michigan, Trump is up by 1 point, both in the two-way and the five-way race. North Carolina, Trump is up 5. When you expand the field, he's up 9. In Pennsylvania, in the two-way race, Trump is up 2 points. In the five-way race, Trump is up 4. And finally, in super swingy Wisconsin, Trump is up 2 points head-to-head. And when you include the others, his margin increases to Trump plus 5. So that would be seven battleground states, six of which went to Biden 4 years ago. And at least right now, in all seven of those states, Donald Trump is ahead. And with more people on the ballot, in most cases, he's up by more. And there's other polls that back this up. This is why Biden and his team are worried and in some ways struggling. A long way to go, but wow. All right, Katie Pavlich is here when we come back.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a brand new hour of The Guy Benson Show right here, right now, live from Charleston, South Carolina. Thank you very much for listening and being here. We so appreciate it. GuyBensonShow.com is our website. That's GuyBensonShow.com. Our podcast is always free and always on demand when the show is over, just after 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Fox News Alert. And the Dow, ugly today, down 570 points at the close. Finishing up at 37,815. Wonder what the markets are reacting to or maybe anticipating. I think we'll get some of the April data coming up. So keep an eye on that, but a brutal day on Wall Street. Big sell-off there. Joining us now is our first of two female guests this hour, both of whom are joining me from Charleston. We're here at the same symposium. Carrie Urban later in the hour with legal analysis on the Trump trial. But now it's Katie Pavlich, editor of townhall.com, my colleague there, and a Fox News contributor, my colleague here as well. Katie, great to see you here and have you here on the program as well.
Hey, Guy. Great to be on your show, as always. Thank you.
So I want to talk a bit about what we heard earlier today. But before we get to that, if I'm not mistaken, you were at the White House Correspondents' Center. I saw you in some fabulous outfits. How was all that?
Well, I'm glad you thought my outfit was fabulous. I did as well. I got to wear my tuxedo that's in my closet because I didn't have time to actually go shop for anything else. So it came in clutch. The dinner was great. It was fun to be with my Fox News colleagues. Had a little bit of an interesting entrance with all the pro-Hamas folks in their masks, you know, braving the streets to say that we were complicit in a genocide that's not going on. So that was interesting. But yeah, it was a fun night. And, of course, you know, you're in a room full of very far-left media members, but I'm glad to be part of the other side of the political spectrum to diversify the crowd. And it was a good time.
So I had heard that fellow Fox News contributor Caitlyn Jenner was in attendance and really got harassed by the Hamas crowd, which is interesting. A very, you could call that very transphobic, actually, by their own rules. But Caitlyn Jenner, from what I heard, was like audibly groaning at some of the lefty stuff happening at the dinner, like having none of it. She's like in her 70s and like no time for BS.
Yeah, I wasn't that close to that table, so I'm not sure, but I do believe that Caitlyn Jenner flipped off the pro-Hamas people on her way in. So there you go.
Yeah, kind of channeling a sentiment felt by so many, I would say.
Yeah, it's like, thank you for doing what the rest of us maybe might be feeling a little bit.
Just a little bit. All right, Katie, so you and I are at this event here in Charleston, and a lot of it is, you know, off the record, so we don't have to get into everything too detailed. But we sat through a presentation about the threat of communist China to the United States. And intellectually, I have known for a long time this is a very serious issue. This is why I've been supportive, for example, of the legislation forcing big changes around TikTok. That's like a no-brainer to me. The list goes on. But sitting there and listening to people who know, right, people who have served at very high levels in the intelligence community, in the Trump administration. I'm going to try to get one of them on this show. We'll see if I can convince him to come on. But I'm just wondering, broad strokes, did you share the sense of alarm that I had over the course of an hour just hearing some of the stories about what the Chinese not only are planning to do but have already done in this country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's highlighting what they've been able to infiltrate through the naivete of people who are supposed to be in charge and protecting the communities in which they serve, you know, public officials, politicians, governors of states, mayors of towns. And, you know, publicly we've seen China trying to buy up all this farmland next to military installations. And we, of course, have also seen them just buying swaths of farmland broadly, you know, infiltrating academia, all kinds of things. And the thing that stands out to me is that when they make these moves, there isn't a lot of questioning about why. And the Chinese Communist Party is given the benefit of the doubt in terms of what their intentions are, as if maybe they're just doing it for a peaceful purpose, when it's obvious to me that if China is buying up land right next to military installations, when they're stealing intellectual property on how to maintain efficient agriculture in our farmlands, when they're smuggling viruses back to China, we've seen a number of academics get arrested for that, that is not something that deserves the benefit of the doubt. It obviously, it is a combative relationship. And yet you have all these decisions being made by people in the U.S. to tolerate some of the things that China wants to do for convenience reasons. Sometimes they benefit financially from these endeavors that the Chinese are trying to implement throughout the country. So again, going back to the biggest standout for me is just that, you know, China does not have a peaceful interest in mind. The things they're doing inside the country are to serve them in a military way down the road, and they're very patient. Might not be tomorrow, might not be in 4 years, might be in 20 years, but they're not doing it for the sake of establishing a footprint in the United States for the sake of embracing American values. They're doing it to eventually take us on.
Yeah, and supplant us in the world, and maybe worse, because, I mean, and you're saying it, some of the actions that have been taken by the Chinese have been aided and abetted by people in this country, including in leadership positions, out of some combination of naivete, I think is the kindest word, Mm-hmm. I would say laziness. I would say there's stupidity. I would say ignorance. I would say greed. Like, there's a combination of reasons, but and maybe we can get into this if I'm able to secure this guest, and I'm going to try, one of the gentlemen who briefed us today, the degree to which they are, I don't think it's even disputed, they are trying to set up a scenario under which if there was a war or if they really felt like they needed to destabilize or defeat the United States, they could do so pretty easily without even really firing a shot from any sort of gun. They could do things to our infrastructure, to our water supply,
right,
to our electrical grids, to our ability just to have a normal life, and also to our supply chains for things that we need, like medicines and all sorts of other things. They could destabilize or even paralyze us if we don't actively reverse. It's not like we've got to prevent some things. We have to reverse what they've already done in this country. And I mean, I just had a few different holy bleep moments sitting there today saying, okay, China is not just a talking point, and it's not just, you know, the virus and then TikTok and, you know, the Confucius Institutes and a few other things that are pretty well known. It goes much deeper and is much broader than that. So I just wanted to put that out there, and hopefully we'll get one of these experts on the show. But relatedly, Katie, in the time that we have left, I'm sure you've been watching this. Our colleague Bill Malugin has been all over it, of course. The not just, you know, small uptick or notable uptick, but the soaring numbers of Chinese nationals entering the country illegally that we know of, not including all the gotaways, of course. When you marry that story, the border crisis and the tens of thousands of Chinese coming across the border illegally, with some of these other things about Chinese infiltration and CCP espionage and that kind of thing, I mean, it makes the border crisis seem perhaps even more urgent than it already is, as, by the way, we're seeing close to 1,000 known gotaways a day. Again, we're up to that level. I mean, it's an issue that clearly has not gone away at all. We're focusing on all sorts of other insanity, like on campuses and that kind of thing. Border crisis just raging on the whole time.
Yeah, raging on. Thousands of people pouring into the country every single day. We have no idea who they are. We do know that many of them have nefarious purposes, especially the ones who come into the country and don't turn themselves in. But on the broader China issue, you know, you're having now tenfold Chinese nationals illegally crossing the border. You're wondering what their intentions are. China has infiltrated every single level of society, of government, of academia in the United States, whether it's the local level, the state level, the federal level. And it's like a cancer that is very difficult to get out. And if people don't realize soon that this will not end well, it's not going to end well at all. And then, of course, you layer on top of it the border crisis, which is being exploited not only by China, which is working, of course, with Mexican cartels and other bad actors, but by other nefarious governments around the world to send people here to surveil, to get information for them, to do things that will benefit their aspirations against the United States.
Oh, and also all the terror watch list people, hundreds of them that have been actually caught. We have no idea who the nearly 2 million gotaways are. And then, I mean, not to mention the cartels, the drugs, the human trafficking, the human suffering and all of that. I mean, it's just a disaster. And we haven't talked about it that much in the last week or so on the show because there's so much else going on. And yet it is still just flashing red. A lot of warning signs for the country right now. It feels like there's a lot at stake. Katie Pavlich, townhall.com, Fox News. Always enjoy it, Katie. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
We'll be right back. I'm Guy Benson. Welcome back. So there was something very strange that happened on national television yesterday. Deeply uncomfortable. I saw Mary Catherine Hamm retweeted, said, okay, I'm uncomfortable, so now you have to be. Sharing the clip. Kamala Harris, who is our vice president, in case you'd forgotten, like, of the country. Also, the border czar. Do a bang-up job at everything. She was on Drew Barrymore's talk show, which I forgot existed, but it's a thing. Drew Barrymore has this show where she interviews celebrities, she, of course, herself being a celebrity. And she's got a little bit of a hippy-dippy, flower child vibe about her, always has. I don't really have an issue with Drew Barrymore, but she's an interesting character. So in this clip that I'm about to play for you, not only is it a weird exchange, they are physically seated so close to each other. Like, I almost feel like Drew Barrymore is invading my personal space, given how close she is to the vice president. And Kamala Harris being sort of odd and strange herself in some ways, she's kind of smiling through the whole thing awkwardly, even though in her eyes there's maybe just a hint or a glint of what is going on here. So Drew Barrymore, first of all, was praising the vice president's laugh. In fact, I think we have, in case you've forgotten what the laugh sounds like, I think we have a montage of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So the vice president, I guess, addressed the fact that her laugh, her chuckle, her cackle, whatever you want to call it, has drawn some attention. So then we get a response to that from Drew Barrymore. And then this very weird, almost touching her suggestion that we need Kamala Harris to become really our collective national mother. Listen to Cut 15.
Sometimes they'll show me little things that just amuse me. Like, apparently, some people love to talk about the way I laugh.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I love your laugh.
Well, I keep thinking in my head that we all need a mom. I've been thinking that we really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah.
But in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
Oh, God. We need you to be Mamala of the country? And the crowd cheers? What, do they, like, give out edibles to everyone in the audience and perhaps on stage? That is weird. And by the way, this insight that we're getting from this Hollywood person, we all need a mom. Well, we all have a mom, right? Not everyone has their mother still with them, but we all have actual moms. We all need a mom, and we just need a big, tremendous hug in the world. And you hear in the background, Kamala's like, ooh, yeah, like, oh, what a great point there, Drew. And then we get it gets even stranger. We need you to be the Mamala of the country. And you can see in the vice president's eyes, like, what is happening right now? Let's just listen one more time to Cut 15, then I have one more point to make.
Sometimes they'll show me little things that just amuse me. Like, apparently, some people love to talk about the way I laugh.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I love your laugh.
Well, I keep thinking in my head that we all need a mom. Mm. I've been thinking that we really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah.
But in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
Oh, I am physically cringing at that. We need you to be Mamala of the country. Oh, I also like how she clarified, I'm thinking in my head. Oh, thank you for that, Drew. That's where the thinking happens. Good stuff. Now, it reminded me, the whole Mamala thing. Here is a celebrity begging this sort of hapless, unpopular vice president of the United States to be all of our collective mother, and calls her Mamala, the Mamala that we all need. It's kind of what Howard Stern said in his sycophantic suck-up interview with the president a few days ago. Remember this? Here's a little mashup of the two. Cut 16.
You're the kind of leader I love because we're lucky to have you in the Oval Office and serving as the father of the country, because if you're a good father to your family, which you are, I know you'd be a good father to the country.
We really all need a tremendous hug in the world right now.
Yeah.
But in our country, we need you to be Mamala of the country.
Oh, what? Like, there's something to probably unpack. I'm not a shrink. Maybe, I don't know, Cookie, one of your professionals, you can get them on this case, because I don't understand why Howard Stern or Drew Barrymore or anyone, but within the span of a few days, they both made a similar point, begging or yearning for Joe Biden to serve as the father to the country. and Kamala Harris to be the mom or mamala to the country. No, thank you. These are politicians. These are people that we elect to do a job. They're doing the job very poorly, which is why their approval ratings are what they are. However they interact with members of their own family, and we know the stories Joe Biden tells about his family, that's their private business. And sometimes it spills over when you've got alleged corruption, for example, with the president's son and their business enrichment scheme that involved Joe Biden as well and all of that. But we don't need Joe Biden to be our father, and we don't need Kamala Harris to be our mother. And even if these were politicians that I really liked, who were doing a very good job, I still would feel that way. That's not the role of a president or a vice president or any elected official. And I think these overly sort of effusive, emotionally invested comments that you get sometimes, it's creepy to me. It's even creepier when it's Joe and Kamala for various reasons. It's just a creepy impulse. No thank you. I have a father. I have a mother. I have a heavenly father. That's plenty. Just do the job and do it well, and we can see how that's going. The Guy Benson Show returns after this break. Carrie Urban is here breaking down the latest developments from the Trump trial. She's Fox's legal editor. That's next.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
We are halfway through the Guy Benson Show on this Tuesday. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. The podcast is always free when the show is over. Joining me now is Carrie Urban, Fox News legal editor, and also one of my dining companions at dinner last night here in Charleston. Carrie, it's great to talk to you about business on the air. Last night was fun, though.
It was fun.
So I'm still kind of getting over that very delicious, very southern meal that we had. I think I have to go back to the gym after the show today. Let's talk about some of the developments in the Trump trial. One of them pretty big. We've been waiting for days on this gag order decision. The prosecution saying that President Trump had violated the gag order where he's not supposed to be talking about the case. And the judge was puzzling over that day after day. Finally, we got a resolution. What was the determination?
The judge found him in contempt of the order, fined him, and we'll see what happens from here. The judge did make an interesting comment, though, saying that he wished he could fine him more and that jail may be preferable at a certain point if the former president continues to violate the gag order. But, Guy, I think I was saying this to you last night. What continues to just make me just not understand what this judge is doing is the fact that he has not imposed a gag order against Michael Cohen as well. If this judge was concerned about the appearance of fairness, which he should be, which all judges normally are, he would impose one against Cohen since Cohen continues to talk publicly about the case, whereas Trump cannot speak about the case. And, you know, and why I think it's especially foolish for the judge not to do so is because it would immediately undercut a lot of the criticism that he's getting with respect to Trump. If he did that, it would show fairness. It would say, look, I'm being even-handed about this. No one's going to talk about this case publicly in a way that I think could damage the outcome or the jury pool, but yet he refuses to do it.
Well, this is a judge, if I'm not mistaken, who is a Joe Biden donor. That's correct, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So,
donated $15.
Yeah, so the appearance of fairness is already, in my mind, dead. You have a judge who gave money, a political contribution, to the opponent of the man who is on trial. Last time these two guys faced off in 2020, now there's a rematch, an upcoming election, and there's a partisan bias with a money trail following this judge. So he's, if I'm not mistaken, he's sided with the prosecution on almost every single motion and issue. Mm-hmm. He says he wishes he had been able to find Donald Trump more. He's at least putting out there maybe he'll throw Trump behind bars if Trump defends himself publicly in the court of public opinion. I'm not sure the judge does care about the appearance of fairness here.
He doesn't care. You're right. And he didn't just donate to Joe Biden for president, his campaign. He donated to a group called Stock Republicans. And what surprises me, and again, small dollar donations, but I said this recently on air, it's not the amount of money. It's that he did it at all. And the reason that matters is because he knew that there were Trump cases percolating in New York City. And let's, you know, not just Trump cases, but I'm sure cases that involve Republicans. Yeah. And so the fact that he chose to go ahead, donate anyway, and to your point, throwing out the appearance of impartiality is just is troubling. You know, obviously, he has this daughter, too, who, you know, he can't control, obviously, one's adult children. But she is a known liberal activist who could benefit from how her father handles this case. He's made these donations. He has, you know, still not decided if he's going to let the former president attend his son's high school graduation. Today he said he thinks he can. But meanwhile, Guy, he had no problem letting court out early for the day because a juror member had to go to the dentist. And then a juror has a flight for Memorial Day weekend. And that's okay for him to rule on already. We're not going to sit for court the Friday before Memorial Day weekend. But yet he still can't tell the president, former president, if he can go to his son's high school graduation. And it's concerning.
So he's playing games there. Because why would he say, because maybe there's a little legal nuance. Because I had read a headline that the judge said, yes, he could go to Barron's graduation. But if that wasn't an actual concrete ruling, just sort of like a general sense, yeah, maybe I think you can. He's not in a position to say, well, I think this, I think that. He's the judge, right? He could rule that, yes, Trump is eligible to go to that event. If he's dragging it on even further, just like he dragged on this gag order thing, that also feels like game playing to me.
Yeah, of course it is. And as of last week, he wouldn't rule on it. Today, the notes that I was reading from our producers inside the courtroom said he thinks he can. And I just noticed the difference in the language. Maybe he cleaned that up as court proceeded. But, you know, I thought to myself, you can say, I think he can about Donald Trump, but yet you can immediately rule on dentist appointments and flights for Memorial Day weekend vacations for your jurors. Come on.
I read an op-ed, it's a couple days old now, in the New York Times. And it's a law professor who watched the opening statements and sort of the beginning of this trial and said that he had felt like this was maybe not a great decision to prosecute Trump this way from the beginning. Then watching the first few days, he's like, this is a mistake of historic proportions, talking about the weakness of the case, the faulty legal theories on which the whole set of felonies is built, having already seen other people, other eyes on this, the feds, the previous DA in Manhattan looking at the same facts and not going down this path, then Bragg coming in and going there anyway. It just feels like, notwithstanding some of the cheerleading that we've seen on some of our competition, there are even-keeled, fair-minded legal analysts who are not conservative Republicans or not MAGA Trump fans who look at this prosecution and they smell something pretty fetid. I think that should matter. I just wonder if it will.
I don't know that it will, but it is a disgrace. And the fact that the person who held the number three spot at the Department of Justice, which is a highly coveted position, it's normally the straight path, the straight shot to becoming a corporate head somewhere, or heading up a U.S. Attorney's Office. For instance, Rudy Giuliani, when he held that position in the early 1980s, he went on to head SDNY, which anyone who's watched the show Billions knows what a powerful spot that is. My colleague who held that spot when I was at DOJ, she is now a top person at Walmart. Yet the person who is currently Alvin Bragg's right hand, who's leading the charge against Donald Trump, who presented opening arguments last week, held that number three spot up until a year and a half ago. So the fact that he would leave that to go do this now is quite something. And I would also say that he knows better. The fact that they were putting together this I don't even know if I can use the word thin, but it is thin at best case. We're not quite sure still what the actual charges are, what the underlying crime that Donald Trump is alleged to have concealed. This is somebody who knows what he's doing, and yet it's coming down to essentially quibbling over how Trump labeled a legal expense. Should he have labeled it a legal expense, this payment to Stormy Daniels, or should he have put reimbursement to Michael Cohen for Stormy Daniels? The fact that someone would put a former president of the United States in jail over that is remarkable.
It seems, and I've read from a number of analysts, and I've run this past some of our guests as well, who are steeped in the legal side of things, which I'm not, but it seems to me, maybe not overly cynical, and I say this as someone who is Trump skeptical, let's put it that way, at best, given the circumstances and on any given day, but I look at this, hopefully, I try to be fair-minded about it. I'm not sure they care about whether or not this is a legitimate prosecution. I'm not sure they care about whether this gets reversed eventually on appeal. I'm not sure they care. I'm sure they would like Trump to be in prison at some point, that they sort of get off on that. That's the whole resistance dream. But I think the purpose of the timing of this trial and the venue of this trial is to get the words convicted felon attached to Donald Trump's name before the election, and that's it. That is job number one, and the prosecution is in on it. This person who left this position, as you point out, very prestigious, at the top of the federal Justice Department to come to the DA office in Manhattan, like locally, to work on this case. It's obviously motivated by something. The judge is donated to Trump's opponent. It seems like there would be collusion, if you will, within these people, within this group, to achieve the goal that I just mentioned, which is very much independent from actual justice. It's politics.
That's right. I think the strategy of the prosecution's office is obscure, obscure, obscure. Obscure what the charges are from Donald Trump so he can't adequately defend himself, and obscure what the case is before the jury. And I think the reason this is pretty clear at this point is because, think about it, last week the prosecution's star witness, David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer, he talked a lot about catch and kill schemes, which is what media does sometimes. They buy rights to a story and they don't publish it. Maybe sleazy, but it's not illegal. Yet there were 2 days devoted to this. Yet that's not part of this case. Catch and kill schemes are not illegal. Entering into an NDA, which is what Trump is alleged to have done through Michael Cohen with Stormy Daniels, also not illegal. Suppressing bad information about oneself, whether you're running for office or not, not illegal. And Michael Cohen, not on trial. Karen McDougal, not part of this case. So prosecution has been attempting to do is put forth some of these sleazy characters with sleazy stories and paint this kind of dirty picture before the jury in the hope that they'll confuse dirty with illegal, but
right.
It's not.
Right. We say it's a crime because we're the lawyers in charge of things, and therefore convict. You don't like the defendant. We all know what's happening right now in the country. There's an election coming up. Look at the sleazy stuff he was doing, and I don't dismiss that it was sleazy and gross. I'm not defending mm-hmm. Trump's conduct,
right.
But there's a difference between bad conduct and criminal conduct. And part of the thing I think that may have blown up in their face, and it kind of depends on who these jurors are and how they're internalizing and computing all this information, but Pecker, who was the lead witness, the first person they put on the stand, he was describing all the other catch and kill examples that he has done through the years for other famous or politically prominent people. That, again, shows that this type of thing is not uncommon and certainly is not a crime. I mean, that's maybe one of the things. You just need one juror, right, to at least hang the case. That might get through to someone.
Yeah, he listed a number of people. Former President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, which got no play, really, in the media. That was not a good day for him. He talked about Tiger Woods. He talked about Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's a common practice. Again, not something that most people deal with in their everyday lives. Don't have to like it. It can be sleazy. Doesn't make it illegal. And also, I thought, interestingly, Pecker testified that he'd been giving Trump a heads up about bad stories about him since 1998. The reason being is that he and Donald Trump had a mutually beneficial relationship. Apparently, when Donald Trump was on the cover of the National Enquirer, they would sell them a lot of magazines. In fact, he sold them the most magazines if he was on the cover, and their readers liked good stories about Donald Trump, not bad ones. And so when Donald Trump announced his intent to run for president, Pecker saw this as an opportunity. He saw this, and that's why he went to him and said, look, I'll be your eyes and ears for the campaign. But it wasn't like this noble, necessarily, aspiration. It was because, yes, he wanted to help Trump and he wanted him to become president, but it also was helping him financially.
Right. And it was also a pre-existing business relationship.
Right.
Doing exactly these kinds of things for years. And I'm sure it was a sordid, ugly business, but it's also, once again, I think pretty clearly not a crime. And they're trying to contort it into a crime for reasons in my mind that are totally political, which brings me to a political question, a little bit more in my realm. I know that your job is the law, but of course you've worked in this neck of the woods. You've been around the block. You understand how politics works as well, Carrie. There's a new poll out today from Emerson and The Hill, and it polls voters in 7 swing states, key states. And within the poll, they ask people about how their opinion of Trump or voting decision might change if Trump is convicted in this trial in New York City. And what's pretty remarkable is there are slight deviations among the 7 states, but overall a plurality, like 45 to 49%, say a conviction would not change their opinion or their decision at all. And then almost an even split of the remainder of these independent voters, these are independents that I'm talking about in response to the conviction hypothetical, plurality saying would make no difference, and then the remaining independents split almost exactly evenly between would make it more likely to vote for him or less likely to vote for him. I just wonder if the message has clearly resonated, it seems, with the American people, including maybe some people not terribly sympathetic to Donald Trump, that this is a totally politicized and not legitimate prosecution. I just wonder what you make of that, number one. And number two, even though I think that's probably a good thing because this does seem so tawdry and disgraceful, to use your word, it's also a problem in terms of people's trust in institutions, including institutions that are supposed to uphold the rule of law and pursue actual justice. I just want to get your thought on that.
I think people have mixed feelings about Donald Trump in this and in these cases. You know, there are people who don't like him, but they say, look, I don't like this guy, but what's happening to him? I don't like that even more. If they can do this to Donald Trump, who was the leader of the free world, who has infinite resources at his disposal, has a lot of money, and they can still attempt to crush him in this way, what chance do I have? And I don't think that people within the Beltway give people enough credit for being smart. And they're seeing through this Democrat lawfare campaign against Trump. It's backfiring, and the polls reflect that. And I think that there was hope, I think, on the Democrat side that some of the stronger cases would be brought first against Trump, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, maybe the January 6th obstruction case. But instead, you have these, you know, effectively garbage cases that have been brought, the civil fraud trial and now this one. And even if someone doesn't like Donald Trump, again, they don't like this more.
Right.
And there's something, I think, within people who are saying, oh, forget this. This is what they're going to do to him. Maybe I do want to be president after all.
Right. And it's a fairness thing, not just to him, and maybe not just the sense that, oh, if they can do it to him, they can do it to me. It's also like, if this is now how elections are going to be fought, that's going to hurt other politicians and political candidates down the line. If this is now the precedent of what you can do successfully to derail an opponent, I think there's also a fairness question there that people are upset about, at least so far in the polls that we're seeing. Carrie Urban is Fox News legal analyst and legal editor at the network, and we so appreciate your time, Carrie, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Guy.
The Guy Benson Show returns after this.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
Ooh, welcome back to the Guy Benson Show. So Nancy Pelosi, former House Speaker, current Democratic Congresswoman, she was on MSNBC talking about the economy, and one of the hosts, Katie Turr, actually asked a question with a bit of pushback. Pelosi didn't like it. Cut 14.
And Joe Biden is doing that, created 9 million jobs in his term in office. Donald Trump has the worst record of job loss of any president. So we just have to make sure people know.
That was a global pandemic.
He had the worst record of any president. We've had other concerns in our country. If you want to be an apologist for Donald Trump, that may be your role, but it ain't mine. And
I don't
he has
think
the worst.
That anybody can accuse
and
me of that.
We.
You want to be an apologist for Donald Trump? She just interjected that obviously the point that Pelosi's making is nonsense. A bunch of jobs were lost because there was a pandemic and we shut down the economy for a while. And then you turn the economy back on and a bunch of the jobs come back and Biden wants credit for that while saying that the incredible economy under Trump until COVID hit, well, none of that counted. But all the job losses, those count. All the worst jobs president ever. That's the Democrat line. And it's so shameless and so unbelievable, literally, that even MSNBC anchors are like, yeah, I don't know about that. And boy, the defensiveness, sort of the snide, angry response to being called out at all from Pelosi. She just goes from 0 to 10 in a nanosecond, accusing Katie Turr of being a Trump apologist. Are you kidding? They are so arrogant. They don't feel like they should ever be challenged. But guess what? The talking point about the economy, obviously not working. Look at any of the polls on Joe Biden and Donald Trump on this front. Absolute failure, but an insight into how Democrats feel entitled to just spout whatever they want without pushback. And they get snarling and nasty at even a hint of being challenged. What a showing there by Nancy Pelosi. Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up next. Charles C.W. Cook joins us talking about the campus madness when we return. We'll be right back.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
Happy Hour on the Guy Benson Show from Charleston, South Carolina today. Thanks for listening. GuyBensonShow.com. That's our website. Podcast is always free when the show is over in less than an hour. And this hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. Terrific. It's an alcoholic beverage, so please drink responsibly, 21 plus only. TheLongDrink.com. Very happy to be here in the American South. Also very happy to welcome back to the show now Charles C.W. Cook, senior writer at National Review. You can check out his podcast, the Charles C.W. Cook Podcast. Charles, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with an example of successful leadership in the realm of college campuses and a lot of the chaos and lawlessness and insanity that we're seeing in recent weeks. And it comes from your state, Florida. The University of Florida, led by former U.S. Senator Ben Sasse, addressing in a statement last night a number of arrests being made, and we're seeing some campuses doing it well, others not so well, to put it kindly. But at the University of Florida, here is the statement from the administration, quote, "This is not complicated. The University of Florida is not a daycare. We do not treat protesters like children. They knew the rules, they broke the rules, and they'll face the consequences. For many days, we have patiently told protesters, many of whom are outside agitators, that they were able to exercise their right to free speech and free assembly. We also told them that clearly prohibited activities would result in a trespassing order from UPD and an interim suspension from the university. These are for students. Today, individuals who refused to comply were arrested after UPD gave multiple warnings and multiple opportunities to comply." End quote. And you can almost hear that statement being dictated verbatim by Sasse himself. I just don't understand. The very first line is, "This is not complicated." I agree. Why has it proven so complicated, seemingly, for so many others?
Because the people who are pretending it's complicated largely agree with the protesters, and they don't think that shutting them down is legitimate. Those people don't understand their roles. They want to be with the protesters. They don't want to be in leadership. They resent that they're in leadership. Whereas Ben Sasse, who has experience, of course, being an evil Republican, doesn't care. That isn't to say Sasse necessarily disagrees or agrees with the protesters in any given protest, but he understands that to make this work, you need neutral rules that are applied irrespective of whether or not faculty or leadership agrees with those who are making a mess. I think Sasse has been exceptional in that regard. That statement is perfect. It says, here are the rules. We told you what they were ahead of time. And by the way, they're good rules. They say First Amendment speech is protected, violence behavior is not. And if you violate them, we will involve the police. And then some people continued, irrespective, and was shocked to see that the University of Florida actually followed through, which is what you have to do if you issue a threat, and what many colleges, including Columbia, have assiduously failed to observe.
We'll come back to Columbia. I want to talk about my alma mater briefly, Northwestern. The encampment at Northwestern started late last week, and I'll just point out that there have been all sorts of incidents now for months, since October 7th. As we've seen on almost every campus, certainly the quote-unquote elite ones, that have been extremely alarming, stomach-turning, deeply concerning to a lot of Jewish students from whom I have heard. So there's a lot of context culminating in this encampment on Deering Meadow at Northwestern. And the school, the very day, actually, that the encampment started, the school had put out a new code of conduct revised for the students. They put out statements. They made it very clear that it would not be permitted to have any sort of encampment on the meadow or anywhere else on campus. And they explicated, here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. It was generally pretty good overall. And they said, and people who violate these rules will be subject to consequences, including arrests, suspensions, and potentially expulsions. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what they said. And within hours, The school sent in a handful of police officers to take down this encampment. They were physically resisted by students and faculty on video, and then they gave up. And the school basically allowed this to happen for a series of days, and then they announced, Charles, yesterday, a breakthrough agreement after negotiations that the encampment will come down later this week, and then a whole bunch of concessions were made to the students, all the things that they can do moving forward. They're going to start, I think, some new endowed professorships in Palestinian studies or something like that, some new Muslim building on campus that they're promising to build. There are a bunch of goodies offered to these kids who apparently agreed to it in exchange for taking down the encampment by Thursday. So I think it's delusional, but I'd imagine some of the leaders at Northwestern are saying, aha, we've threaded the needle between really over-the-top bringing down the hammer like we're seeing at the University of Florida, and then on the other hand, the mess at Columbia. We've come up with a third way here where we had good faith negotiations, and look, we've resolved this peacefully without the spectacle of all these arrests and that kind of thing. I wonder what you make of that.
Well, if the faculty at Northwestern really do believe that Florida was over the top in performing its primary duty, which is to keep order, then they're out of their minds. And that word you used, agreement, why should there be an agreement?
Right.
There's a video during the rounds of Ronald Reagan responding to campus protests, riots in one case in California in the 60s, and someone stands up and says to him, you know, we want to negotiate. He says there's nothing to negotiate. If somebody comes into my house without permission, we don't form an agreement between us. I don't sit and listen to the concessions that they want. I don't compromise. Florida's got it right because Florida has laid out what is permissible and what is not. First Amendment speech is permissible in all circumstances. Rioting, encampments, violence, harassment are not. This is the first mistake that Northwestern and others have made, is to view student protesters as if they have special rights that nobody else has, as if they and nobody else is permitted to go beyond their First Amendment protections, as if there's something in our social compact that allows you to occupy space or threaten others or shut down public thoroughfares if you really believe what you're saying. Well, there's not. It's crazy.
I know,
that's how I think of it.
Totally crazy. And just to point out a few other of these concessions that Northwestern has granted, it's full-ride scholarships for Palestinian students, new positions for Palestinian faculty. These are part of the elements that were offered and ultimately accepted. And by the way, it's hilarious because these pro-Palestine, really pro-Hamas groups, put out on social media their victory statements about this, and they are getting absolutely torched in the comments by their own comrades who are calling them sellouts and all these other things. So that's sort of enjoyable. You can grab the popcorn for what it's worth. But what I'm concerned about at Northwestern specifically is, here's a negotiation that the school entered into thinking it was doing the right thing, not being too draconian, but not letting this drag on even longer. They probably feel like it's like the got it just right middle ground. And the problem is they have absolutely incentivized future encampments, future terrible behavior by students and faculty, by saying if you do these things, you will get the university to sit down with you and give you many things that you want in exchange for some face-saving activity or some face-saving move on your part. It guarantees additional terrible behavior in the future, and it's very unclear, and therefore I'm skeptical. I've put in an inquiry. We'll see what they say. But I'm skeptical that there's going to be any sort of real meaningful consequence for the students and the faculty members, for example, shoving police officers physically on camera. There was another student, I believe, they're all wearing masks, of course, who went up and assaulted a student journalist who was just filming out on the quad what was happening. This person came over and assaulted the journalist. I'm not sure there's going to be any punishment for any of those people. It just feels utterly deluded if the administration believes this is going to be a sustainable, good solution when the inevitable next thing happens, whether it's tied to Gaza or whatever it might be. This is a hardcore left-wing thing that we're talking about, and some lessons are being learned here.
So what you've described is 101 of dealing with people who are breaking the law or being unreasonable. And again, it seems obvious here in Florida and not obvious elsewhere. They will come back. They will ask for more. And they won't stop. What sticks in my craw about this more than anything else is the double standard. On the one hand, the people we're talking about believe that the system itself is illegitimate, needs to be torn up, is corrupt. That's the only explanation, for the record, as to why you would protest at Columbia or Northwestern about something that is happening in the Middle East. Because Columbia and Northwestern don't control that. They don't control the U.S. government. They don't control Israel. They didn't create the geopolitical conditions underneath this. But you have to believe that the whole system is corrupt. And when you listen to interviews with these protesters, that's what they say. But then on the other hand, they want to be treated with all of the benefits and offshoots of the very Western civilization that they decry. I saw a video from Britain recently in which a guy was who had been throwing paint at paintings and sticking his hand to the ground and so on in the name of climate activism was complaining outside a police station that he had been arrested improperly. He had a book with rules in it. And his speech flitted between there is something rotten about Britain from the ground up that needs to be destroyed. The system is illegitimate. The police are animals and so on. And you didn't arrest me properly. Right. And of course, that's what we're seeing here as well, is that on the one hand, it's down with Western civilization. Last night at Columbia, somebody hung an Intifada banner from a building that was occupied. All the rules go out the window, except when it suits them. Suddenly, the First Amendment has to be observed, a very expensive reading of the First Amendment, I should say, that includes rioting and stealing property. The police are expected to treat them with kid gloves. The faculty are supposed to be inspired by these mythical higher principles. It's ridiculous. You know, not that I am in any way defending actual revolutionaries. Most actual revolutionaries don't behave like that. They just take the system out.
They also understand, certainly in the West, that if you're going to engage in conduct that crosses lines and becomes, at best, civil disobedience, if you want to call it that, there are consequences attached to those decisions. And so what these kids and brats want is they want all the cosplaying of radicalism without any of the consequences. And in fact, I want to pull on that thread a little further when we come back after this short break with Charles C.W. Cook on The Guy Benson Show.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
We're back. It's The Guy Benson Show. Charles C.W. Cook is with us. And we were talking about this before the break. Charles, there was actually an Associated Press story, I'm not sure if you saw it this week, talking about how they are now demanding, this is a new demand, that they have no consequences, that any sort of suspensions or arrests be expunged from their records. They don't want this following them later in life. They quote a bunch of students saying that it's, you know, very disturbing and feels dystopian that they haven't been given concrete answers about when their disciplinary hearings are going to be and whether they're going to be able to graduate on time or at all. And it's all up to the institutions whose rules they have flouted openly, gleefully. The institutions now owe them all these other things as well. And it's outrageous that they're not getting what they want. I mean, they truly feel entitled to all of the good things and none of the bad things, and a consequence-free environment, Charles. And yet, unfortunately, in a lot of places, that impulse is being rewarded and reinforced. I mean, these are people, and others have pointed this out as well, They wear masks in public to not be identified. They sign statements anonymously. They insist on no consequences for anything. They want all of the things that make them feel good and none of the things that don't. And in far too many cases, a lot of the adults are saying, yeah, let's see how we can accommodate that.
I do not want to detract from my criticism of the students who have agency and ought to be held accountable. But as you have just implied, the root problem here is in what's happened to colleges in the West.
Yep.
The fundamental issue, because ultimately, and the universities who have got this right have shown this, the adults are still in charge if they want to be. The mere prospect for most of these protesters of being denied the certificate that they covet that says Columbia on it or Harvard on it or Northwestern would be sufficient to end this quite quickly. We do not lack for police officers in the United States, but the faculty and the boards and the presidents, they just don't want to. Why? Because the result of a process that has taken 60 years, they are themselves older versions of the very radicals we're discussing. People are always shocked when I tell them this, but this was by design. This was the result of a 1963 statement by Students for a Democratic Society in which they said quite openly, we are going to take over the universities. That's a source of power in this country. And they did it.
Yeah, and they have.
It's not a conspiracy theory. They did it.
Yeah, and I would say some of these people that you're talking about, the adults, are themselves radicals or at least somewhat sympathetic to what's happening. That's part of it. And I think others realize this is unsustainable and crazy and madness and can't go on, but they are craven and gutless and unable to actually summon any courage to do what's necessary because they're surrounded by people who agree with the protesters or who envy them and kind of want to be part of it themselves. That's the reality at a lot of these places. And Americans are watching. And I'm hoping that there'll be some sort of a tipping point where people are so disgusted with what's happening in elite circles that elite institutions lose their luster and their prestige in a lot of ways. But we're watching this be really destroyed from within, which is sad to see, but maybe something that had to happen to some extent. But that doesn't change the horrifying reality for so many Jewish students, at least in this moment, of what's being indulged or permitted in the name of who knows what. It's a moving target, as you note. Charles C.W. Cook, National Review, a senior writer there. His podcast is the Charles C.W. Cook Podcast, easy to remember. Charles, as always, we appreciate your time. We'll talk soon.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
It's the Guy Benson Show, continuing after this.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
We had a great conversation earlier in the program today with my friend and my colleague, Katie Pavlich of Town Hall and Fox News. Here's a taste of that exchange. Did you share the sense of alarm that I had over the course of an hour just hearing some of the stories about what the Chinese not only are planning to do but have already done in this country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's highlighting what they've been able to infiltrate through the naivete of people who are supposed to be in charge and protecting the communities in which they serve, you know, public officials, politicians, governors of states, mayors of towns. And, you know, publicly, we've seen China trying to buy up all this farmland next to military installations. And we, of course, have also seen them just buying swaths of farmland broadly, you know, infiltrating academia, all kinds of things. And the thing that stands out to me is that when they make these moves, there isn't a lot of questioning about why. And the Chinese Communist Party is given the benefit of the doubt in terms of what their intentions are, as if maybe they're just doing it for a peaceful purpose, when it's obvious to me that if China is buying up land right next to military installations, when they're stealing intellectual property
on how to maintain efficient agriculture in our farmlands when they're smuggling viruses back to China. We've seen a number of academics get arrested for that. But that is not something that deserves the benefit of the doubt. It obviously, it is a combative relationship. And yet you have all these decisions being made by people in the U.S. to tolerate some of the things that China wants to do for convenience reasons. Sometimes they benefit financially from these endeavors that the Chinese are trying to implement throughout the country. So, again, going back to the biggest standout for me is just that, you know, China does not have a peaceful interest in mind. The things they're doing inside the country are to serve them in a military way down the road, and they're very patient. Might not be tomorrow, might not be in 4 years, might be in 20 years, but they're not doing it for the sake of establishing a footprint in the United States for the sake of embracing American values. They're doing it to eventually take us on.
Yeah, and supplant us in the world, and maybe worse, because, I mean, and you're saying some of the actions that have been taken by the Chinese have been aided and abetted by people in this country, including in leadership positions, out of some combination of naivete, I think is the kindest word. Mm-hmm. I would say laziness. I would say
there's
stupidity. I would say ignorance. I would say greed. Like, there's a combination of reasons, but, and maybe we can get into this if I'm able to secure this guest, and I'm going to try, one of the gentlemen who briefed us today, the degree to which they are, I don't think it's even disputed, they are trying to set up a scenario under which if there was a war or if they really felt like they needed to destabilize or defeat the United States, they could do so pretty easily without mm-hmm. even really firing a shot from any sort of gun. They could do things to our infrastructure, to our water supply,
right,
to our electrical grids, to our ability just to have a normal life, and also to our supply chains for things that we need, like medicines and all sorts of other things. They could destabilize or even paralyze us if we don't actively reverse. It's not like we've got to prevent some things. We have to reverse what they've already done in this country. And I mean, I just had a few different holy bleep moments sitting there today saying, okay, China's not just a talking point, and it's not just, you know, the virus and then TikTok and, you know, the Confucius Institutes and a few other things that are pretty well known. It goes much deeper and is much broader than that. So I just wanted to put that out there, and hopefully we'll get one of these experts on the show. But relatedly, Katie, in the time that we have left, I'm sure you've been watching this. Our colleague Bill Malugin has been all over it, of course. The not just, you know, small uptick or notable uptick, but the soaring numbers of Chinese nationals entering the country illegally that we know of, not including all the gotaways, of course. When you marry that story, the border crisis and the tens of thousands of Chinese coming across the border illegally, with some of these other things about Chinese infiltration and CCP espionage and that kind of thing, I mean, it makes the border crisis seem perhaps even more urgent than it already is, as, by the way, we're seeing close to 1,000 known gotaways a day. Again, we're up to that level. I mean, it's an issue that clearly has not gone away at all. We're focusing on all sorts of other insanity, like on campuses and that kind of thing. Border crisis just raging on the whole time.
Yeah, raging on. Thousands of people pouring into the country every single day. We have no idea who they are. We do know that many of them have nefarious purposes, especially the ones who come into the country and don't turn themselves in.
My full interview with Katie Pavlich available online, GuyBensonShow.com. Also part of the free podcast. It's the whole show, every day, on demand, absolutely free of charge. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, the home stretch, producer Christine wants an apology. We'll see if we give her one. And she also wants to produce a major event coming up in my life. We'll see about that next.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch on the Guy Benson Show, Tuesday edition from Charleston. Beautiful city here in South Carolina. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Podcast is always free. So in this space, on yesterday's show, we were talking about Christine and her affinity for, well, offing animals, let's be frank, and why she's now a big fan of Christy Nome and that whole blow-up. Her husband Bobby heard the segment and thought that we painted her as a fanatical animal killer. And he also added that we weren't necessarily wrong to portray her that way, but still, she was demanding an apology from us. Christine, I mean, you're not getting an apology, first of all, but was Bobby, just looking at you, I'm sure he sometimes has questions, concerns, curiosities, being like, why would you admit to defending Christy Nome here, given the whole storyline we have about you with Carousel? I'm sure he maybe questioned the judgment of stepping up to the plate for Christy Nome in this context.
Yeah, he said that there was just, you cannot defend shooting a puppy. Like, there's just no way around it.
Yeah, he had to say this to you.
You just cannot defend shooting a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I disagree with him. Maybe you know the answer. He told me that she also, in the same day, killed her goat. I had read, I thought Cricket had half killed the goat, so then she just finished the job. And he said that counts as shooting the goat and killing it.
Oh, like putting the goat out of its misery.
Right, because of Cricket the dog.
Right, sort of a killing done out of compassion, at least. That's what she claims. I mean, I assume you're fine with it either way. You know, you've got a dead goat. It's like two thumbs up, whether it's compassion killing or whether it was just a, you know, a fit of pique or passion. You know, you got to do what you got to do. Is that your position?
Well, I mean, like, especially with the goat, like, kind of like Old Yeller, right? Like, you just got to put it out its misery.
What if the goat was just looking at her weird and she didn't really like the way the goat was giving her attitude?
Well, I just don't think that's what happened. I think.
Hypothetically, though.
Well, yeah, I guess you don't kill goats, you know? If you're not going to kill a puppy, you shouldn't probably kill goats.
Seems like you're on the fence on that one.
Well,
okay, so let's move on. Would you like to add something?
Yeah, I would like to add that I would like an apology from actually every single person on this team. Justin, you seem to agree with Guy a lot of yesterday. And Dylan didn't say a word, didn't speak up or defend Cooks, his best friend.
Probably for the best. My guess is he was doing you a favor by not speaking up because you wouldn't have liked what he said. Dylan, am I correct in that hypothesis?
When I heard that you were defending Christy Nome for shooting a dog, I had no words. I was speechless. I had nothing in defense.
But
so.
Didn't you hear what Cricket did?
I heard what Cricket did, and
allegedly.
I think that I allegedly heard what Cricket did, and I think that she has a massive social media following and could have easily rehomed the dog.
Mm-hmm. And the details have changed and shifted. I'll point that out. So just in a word, yes or no, Dylan, is there an apology coming for Christine on this from you?
No.
No. Okay. Justin, yes or no?
Not for me.
Okay, yeah. So that's trifecta, 0-3, Christine.
I'm not talking to any of you for the rest of the day.
Well, except for this next topic.
Oh, right.
Yeah, because we have another one here. So I, over the weekend, put up a poll on Twitter. So we're at Guy Benson Show on Twitter and Instagram here at the program. Personally, I'm at Guy P. Benson for both, Twitter or X and Instagram. So feel free to follow me. I haven't plugged that in a while. I'm not thirsty for followers, but if you want to, by all means, I'm much more political on Twitter and much more sort of personal on Instagram, Guy P. Benson. So I actually posted it on both my Instagram stories and on Twitter, a poll about something happening in my life next year. So we're way in advance. This isn't happening imminently, but next year, 2025, I will be turning the big 4-0. And that's significant in my life. And so there's a plan that we are starting to put together, including airfare, bookings, and that kind of thing, where we're going to go as a couple out of the country and spend some time sort of sightseeing and that kind of thing. And then we're planning on going from Asia, which is where we're heading, to Hawaii for at least a few days. I think 4 nights is what we settled on. And we've just put out a message to a very close circle of friends saying, hey, big birthday trip. If you are interested, no pressure. It's not like we're organizing some big event or paying for anything. But if you want to come and hang out with us in Hawaii at a beautiful place, by the pool or whatever for a couple days and have some cocktails and nice meals. We would love to see you. And we are already getting quite a lot of response, like a higher percentage of yes than I was expecting from our friends. And the question that they keep asking me is the obvious one. Okay, what are the dates? What are the details? We have the dates, but we don't have the details. We have the flights, but not the accommodations, because we are still trying to settle on not only which resort we're going to stay at, but also which island of Hawaii we're going to stay at. I have not been to Hawaii since I was a little tiny kid. I have almost no memory of it at all. People rave about its beauty. It's also on the way home from Asia, so it just seems like it makes sense as a destination. It's something we've been looking forward to. I've been saving up for this trip, all those good things. And so I put on my social media this poll, where should we go? And I listed four of the main islands, and I asked people just to give advice if they're familiar with Hawaii. And I got, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of responses and votes and all this stuff, and people had lots of opinions. I think the plurality has leaned in the direction of Maui, but there are strong defenders of other options as well. And so then you chimed in, Christine, saying, number one, you want to produce this trip for me. And number two, unsurprisingly, you're curious why you weren't invited. And then number three, you also have advice because I believe you did your honeymoon in Hawaii. So you had a lot to say. So I'm going to allow you to say the things in whatever order you would like as we anticipate this trip months from now.
Okay. So on any other day, I probably would ask why I haven't been invited, or I probably would have accepted my invitation. Maybe we're just waiting to do it on air. Today I'm a little angry, so.
Oh, I thought you were going to say today you understand why we wouldn't want a pony killer and puppy killing apologist on the trip. Like, I thought maybe you were having a light bulb go off.
No.
No, you're saying you're the victim?
Yeah. I really do. I actually kind of am a little offended that I'm not invited to this. I mean, we are best friends, and this is your 40th birthday. This is a big deal.
So, yeah, like, yeah. Well, I mean, okay, I'll say this.
Okay.
You're not invited, and that's not going to change. But we were just having a conversation last night. We did a very small Christmas party last year. The big one was put on hold because we had an infant at home, like a total newborn. So the big old party that we love doing, that you've been to multiple times, was paused. We kept it alive, the tradition with, like, neighbors, but that's it. It's coming back, God willing, full bore, this coming Christmas, and I think we have a date already in mind, and you will be invited.
Oh, no, I want the birthday.
Well, would you prefer it's like birthday or nothing?
Oh, gosh, now you sound like a parent. You sound like Judgy Joyce.
Or are you going to say yes, thank you to one of the two?
Well, obviously I'm going to go.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
But,
so,
okay.
Would you like to make some points about Hawaii?
I would. Okay. So Bobby and I spent 14 days in Hawaii. And we started off in Honolulu, which was lovely. But I wouldn't spend – I mean, obviously you're going to go to Pearl Harbor, but I wouldn't spend a ton of time there.
Well, we might. Like, I want to go to Pearl Harbor. I want to see it. I've never been there. But I don't have a lot of time there. And if we're not going to stay on Oahu, which is the island where Honolulu is, and by the way, I was wrong about that. I always thought Honolulu was on the Big Island. Nope. It's on Oahu. Do I want to take time out of a vacation to take a detour to see Pearl Harbor? I don't know. The answer is I'm a maybe on that.
Okay. Well, our favorite island we spent a week on was Kauai.
Okay.
Hands down, the most beautiful place I've ever seen. Like, you
this
felt
this is what Katie Pavlich has been pushing.
Oh my gosh. In some way, when you're driving, you know, these like streets, you just these roads, you just like feel like you're part of like Jurassic Park or something. It's like I've never seen the color green like that before. The only thing I will say is we stayed at a beautiful resort, had a great time. Actually, you know what's so funny? I became friends with Jennifer Aniston's stepmother there. So her and I would have drinks like almost every night together.
Was she actually, or was she claiming to be?
No, she actually was. She was married to John Aniston. And if anybody knows, it was, I think he passed away, Victor Kiriakis on Days of Our Lives. So I had spotted him first at the pool and I was like obsessed with Days of Our Lives. So, and then it just, we bumped into each other and her and I just, we would have a drink almost
You're
every
a big,
night.
Soap opera fan?
I used to be. I used to be. I mean, now
I'm
a working lady, mm-hmm. so I don't have time. But, oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. I loved all the soap operas.
Okay, so
anyway,
Kauai.
Kauai was beautiful. The only thing about Kauai, maybe it was just the side of the island we were on. You could not go swimming in the ocean. Mm. It was so rough.
And I've heard it's a little sleepy, a little quieter overall, which is a plus. It's a plus to some people, but if you're looking for a balance, that's why I feel like Maui might be the balance. Do you have any thoughts on Maui?
Yeah. So one more thing. That's true about Kauai. You know, and we were on our honeymoon, and we were just exhausted from, you know, all the events leading up to the wedding. So we would really just go to dinner, maybe sit at the piano bar, and, like, we were sleeping by
you're like, I'm done.
We were done by 10 o'clock every night. We were exhausted. I do have to tell you, though, I went horseback riding. On Kauai, on the island.
Oh, what happened to that horse?
She was a little vicious, I have to say. I don't know. Maybe it's just me and horses. This horse was red, too, and so was Carousel. So I knew going into it, it wasn't going to be the greatest. But it was a really cool experience. Like, you literally take the horse into the ocean. It was great.
Maybe I should go to Kauai just to pay respects to that horse's memory, whatever happened to that poor thing. Just quickly
okay.
on – we're almost
Maui.
Out of time. Maui.
Maui, okay. I have mixed thoughts on Maui. We stayed at the Four Seasons, so it was absolutely stunning, you know.
Cha-ching.
Yes. Oh, yes. But other than that, I didn't find Maui to be, you know, anything. Like, we were driving, and I was like, oh, there's a Macy's. There's a Chili's. There's, you know, an Old Navy. Like, it had a it was kind of commercial.
More commercial. Mm-hmm. I would want a nice resort where you're kind of away from all the hustle bustle with nice views of the ocean. That's a big thing for me. The price is a factor as well. So I will take all of this under advisement. We have many months to go, so perhaps we can follow up on this discussion. But for now, out of time. Back here tomorrow, hopefully back in D.C. on the Guy Benson Show. Same time, same place. We'll talk to you then.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.